Penguin Random House Audio presents Paradise Falls, The True Story of an Environmental Catastrophe by Keith O'Brien. Read for you by Eileen Stevens. Betwixt the Lake Ontario and Erie, there is a vast and prodigious cadence of water which falls down. This wonderful downfall is compounded of two great cross streams of water and two falls, with an aisle sloping along the middle of it. The waters which fall from this vast height do foam and boil after the most hideous manner imaginable, making an outrageous noise, more terrible than that of thunder. For when the wind blows from off the south, their dismal roaring may be heard above 15 leagues off. Father Louis Hennepin, a Catholic missionary and explorer, upon visiting Niagara Falls in 1679. Author's note. This story is a work of nonfiction, built with the help of 130 hours of interviews and thousands of primary source documents never before utilized, including nearly 1,000 pages obtained with a Freedom of Information request filed with the state of New York, and hundreds of other important documents unearthed from boxes that had been kept in people's attics, basements, storage units, and file cabinets for decades. It takes no license with facts, characters, scenes, or chronologies. If something appears in quotation marks here, it means it is verified, taken directly from a memo, letter, journal, legal deposition, testimony, case filing, memoir, or press account, or in rare instances, confirmed by reliable sources who took part in the conversation. Every effort has been made to portray the events as they occurred, to depict emotions as they were felt at the time, and to record them as accurately as possible for history. Introduction. May 14th, 1972. It was a Sunday afternoon, almost summer in Niagara Falls, and the children from the little bungalows on the east side of town scampered outside to play. The parents, mostly factory workers and housewives, didn't follow them. No adults were going to lord over the kids with rules and warnings that afternoon, because everyone knew the LaSalle neighborhood was safe, and everyone knew where the kids were going. To the playground, they called it, a rectangular expanse of open land around the elementary school between 97th and 99th streets in the heart of the neighborhood. There were some play structures there, a swing set, a slide, and a baseball diamond too, but mostly the grounds were wild, nearly 16 acres of grassland, growing in clumps, untended and untamed. Parents sometimes wondered why no one had developed the property, dropped in among the tidy rows of single-story starter homes. It seemed as if someone should have built a real park there years ago. But the children asked no questions because, for them, the land was perfect. The vacant lot to end all lots, a place filled with possibility, and maybe even magic. The older boys, straddling their dirt bikes in tight shorts and white tube socks, told fantastic tales of rocks at the playground that burst into flames, that spontaneously combusted. They said they had seen it with their own eyes. Debbie Gallo, 11 years old with dark hair and hazel eyes, wasn't sure what to believe about the fire rocks. Her father was a welder, a son of Italian immigrants, and a Korean War veteran who walked with a limp from the shrapnel that had carved up one of his knees. The Gallos felt fortunate just to own a home in the neighborhood, and Debbie felt lucky that it was this one, on 97th Street. Her little one-story house, white with olive-green shutters, looked right out over the school and the empty land. She could be on the playground almost before the front door slammed behind her, skipping across the street to the open lot. On weekdays, it meant that she didn't have to walk far to get to her fifth-grade class at the school. On weekends, it meant that her front yard seemed to stretch on like the sea, forever, with friends floating everywhere, coming and going on roller skates and bicycles. This Sunday was one of those days, so Debbie laced up her shoes and headed outside. It was warm and windy. A spring storm was coming, but Debbie and her girlfriends paid the weather and the boys around them no mind. While the boys churned up dust at the playground with their bicycles, clattering here and there on narrow paths carved into the high grass, the girls set about creating something pretty, sidewalk art. At their feet, they began gathering chunks of rock to use as chalk. The rocks were soft and white. The whitest white I'd ever seen, Debbie would say later. And best of all, they were easy for the girls to find amid the topsoil. Debbie took one in each hand, ran them between her fingers, and then got down on her knees to draw on the concrete. Later, she couldn't remember how much time elapsed before her eyes began to burn. Had she been playing with the rocks for 5 minutes or 15 seconds? She wasn't sure. All she knew was that rubbing her eyes only made them worse. As she pulled her hands away, the pain came on like a wave, hot and searing. Her eyes burned as if from the inside. And then she was screaming, and she was running, stumbling across the playground, trying to find her way back to her house on 97th Street through a haze of tears and gauzy darkness. It wasn't just the pain that worried Debbie at this point. It was the panic growing inside her. Panic over a realization that was hard to explain to her mother back at the house. Debbie Gallo couldn't open her eyes. She couldn't see. For one brief and scary moment, she was blind. That night at the hospital, a short walk from the iconic waterfalls, the tourist hotels lined up along the River Gorge downtown, the young newlyweds walking hand in hand in a place still clinging to its reputation as the honeymoon capital of the world, and the souvenir vendors selling t-shirts, tchotchkes, and picture-perfect postcards from Niagara Falls. Doctors flushed out Debbie's eyes, pronounced her okay, and sent her home. The next morning, she went to school as usual. But problems continued at the playground that Monday. Two boys, both third graders, also experienced burning around their eyes and went to see the school nurse. Someone reported the issue to the city fire department, and around 2:30 that afternoon, a fire official placed a phone call, not to the school, but to a chemical plant along the Niagara River just east of the tourist district. He wanted to speak to the safety supervisor at Hooker Chemical, the largest employer and industrial taxpayer in town, with a sprawling 135-acre campus on Buffalo Avenue. Within 15 minutes, the head custodian for the Niagara Falls Board of Education was waiting in a car outside Hooker's main gate. The safety supervisor hopped in, and together the pair drove straight for the school, where, working efficiently, they conducted a series of interviews with the principal, the school nurse, and Debbie Gallo, too. Hooker's safety expert then walked outside to the playground to inspect the grounds for himself. The rains had moved in the night before, washing away Debbie's chalk art and filling the playground with puddles. But it didn't take long to find the evidence the children had reported. The safety supervisor spotted the rocks near the bicycle racks along the southern wall of the school, collected a sample, and brought it inside to the nurse, just to confirm. The nurse had not only treated the two boys that morning. By chance, she had cared for Debbie the night before in the emergency room. And when presented with the white rocks, this mushy material, whatever it was, the nurse noted that it smelled just like Debbie when she had been scared and blind and crying. Hooker's man returned to the plant that afternoon and typed up a one-page report about what had happened that day. Across the top of the page, in large block letters, the report was stamped confidential, though the safety supervisor made sure to send a copy to the company's insurance department, just in case. After all, it wasn't the first time Hooker had received phone calls about problems at the playground between 97th and 99th Streets, and it wouldn't be the last. Just 2 days later, a city health official asked Hooker's safety supervisor to return to investigate a different problem. A metal drum had surfaced this time, belching what could only be described as rust-colored material. For residents, these events were the latest in a litany of curious plights and odd problems. In recent years, people had reported chemical stenches in their basements, floating clouds of acidic fumes that made it hard to breathe, gas leaks that stopped traffic for hours outside the Hooker
Sample complete. Ready to continue?